Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, and you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Podcasts are available under Public Affairs. Today is March 4th, 2020. The markets were up today with the Dow closing at 27,090, the NASDAQ at 9,018, and the S&P at 3,130. Got to get used to this ups and downs. Tonight, we are taking questions, listeners' tax questions, and I'm calling it more listeners' tax questions because we did this a couple weeks ago and had lots of calls, and it's my favorite part of the show. That's why I like this time of year, tax time, because people tend to have a lot of questions, and so I'm very happy to accommodate. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Lori C's in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay, and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments, and while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic, and I will do my best to answer. The number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, you can give your question to Lori. She'll write it down and she'll bring it into the studio. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. Through that website, we actually had a couple questions right before the show tonight, which were great and actually have a lot of information in them. So I thought they were great questions, and I thought we would start with those. But again, if you have a question, you can call in live and we can discuss it, or you can give it to Lori and she'll write it down. Again, the phone number is 610-758-8810. So Sam from Arcata, if I'm saying it right, Arcata, California, emailed in a question, and he had said 529 education accounts, comparing it to Roth IRAs as for early distribution penalty, and if 529 accounts have a 60-day return setup like the Roth IRAs do. So there's a lot in that question. And so I kind of broke it down. He asked for a bit of a comparison. So I talked a little bit about how they might have some similarities, but then I talked about the differences as well. So I did already respond to Sam. Thank you for sending in that question. We appreciate it. So in comparing, both a 529 and a Roth IRA allow tax-free growth and income if invested for their qualified purposes. So think about a 529 is an education account, and if we're using it for that, then the IRS incents us to put contributions into a 529 and use it for education, and that is the way it is going to grow and have tax-free earnings and growth for us. So that's what I mean by qualified purposes. And the same thing with the Roth, the IRS is encouraging us to save for retirement. And so for people who have the ability to contribute to a Roth or perhaps convert IRA money to a Roth, in the Roth, you have tax-free growth if used, again, for retirement, and it's a qualified distribution. You can avoid paying income taxes on the earnings and income on it. Both if invested and only distributed in a qualified distribution would be income tax-free. So these are careful words I'm using when we talk about qualified distribution. Both can have named beneficiaries, and both allow you to change the beneficiary. So there are some similarities between the 529 and the Roth. Not sure why Sam put those two together, but I thought that's it was an interesting discussion. Now, to further discuss the Roth and where he talks about early distribution penalties, the Roth is used for retirement. The 529 is used for education. So that is where there's some differences. And after the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, the earnings would be income tax free on a distribution. So that's a little, that's different than the education one. After the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, the earnings would be income tax free on distribution. So if you're age 59 and you put $7,000 into a Roth, and 2 years later that $7,000 has grown to $7,200, if you took it all out, you would have to pay income tax on the $200 penalties and income tax because it wasn't the longer of 5 years. Now, that's why back when Roths first started, 20 years ago, people said, if you had the ability to set up a Roth, you could do it. And that started that five-year clock. So if you already have a Roth, had already established a Roth, then you've already might have started that five-year clock and you don't need to worry about it. It doesn't start with each new contribution, which is very different than a conversion, a Roth conversion. This is like the what I would call the traditional Roth bucket, okay? So you put money in, it's after tax dollars. The longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, when you take it out, the earnings would be income tax free on distribution. Quite often, I see people using these really from an estate planning avenue as well, so that they're not typically taking money out of these Roths after those number of years, even though they're allowed to. What's nice, I kind of use it sometimes for tax planning. If someone's going to go over a certain income threshold, I might say, hey, why don't we take the money out of the Roth instead of the IRA if it's going to help them save money in other ways. All right. I'm getting sidetracked from my answer to Sam. let me stick to the script here a little bit. So I had mentioned after longer 5 years or age 59 and a half, the earnings would be income tax free on distribution. Until then, if a distribution is needed, the original contributions come out first, and you would not have income tax on the original contribution. So the IRS isn't going to tax you on the original contribution because that was after tax money. Again, conversions, they have some additional rules, so I'm not going to get into that right now. So that's why it's really important to track your original contributions in a Roth in case you need to tap it. You want to know what you originally put in. Don't take out the earnings to avoid those penalties and taxes. If you also take out earnings before 5 years or age 59 and a half, then you would have income tax and penalties, but it's only on those earnings and gains, not on the original contributions. And some people get confused by that. So if you were, in my example of the, I put 7,000 in, it grew to 7,200 and I took out the total, it's only going to be tax and penalties on the 200 if I take it out in what I'm going to call an unqualified distribution, okay? To set up a Roth, you have to have earned income or a spouse who has earned income, and you have to be under certain income thresholds in order to establish a Roth. So if you're making, you know, boatloads of money, you might not be able to do it. So that's why it's really a great option for young people when they're first starting out to set up a Roth and get that going. It's get that tax-free growth in earnings as soon as you can. Last week, I talked about the time value of money, and I talked about someone putting in $2,000, I think, a year starting at age 18 and how much that accumulated to by the age of 65. You throw it into a Roth, and wow, you really got not only the power of the compounding, but also the power of income tax-free growth. You have until April 15th of the year following the current year to establish and fund the Roth. So you have, for example, till April 15th to fund it for 2019. When we come back from the break, I'm going to talk about the 529 features in answering Sam's question about the differences between 529s and Roths. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. 8810. You can talk live on air with us. And if you are not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori. She'll write it down and she'll bring it in to me. We will be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. You can listen online as well at WDIY.org. For friends and family who are outside our listening area, it's a great way to tap into the live stream. Or if you're not available during the regularly scheduled program, podcasts are available under Public Affairs. We are taking more listeners' tax questions this evening, and we had a couple come through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. Sam's question was regarding 529 education accounts and comparing it to Roth IRAs for early distribution penalties, and if 529s have a 60-day return setup like Roth IRAs, and I'll explain what that is as we go through this. So I just talked about some of the similarities and then the purpose of the Roth. And now I would like to refer to the education accounts. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. And you can talk live on air or give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in to me at 610-758-8810. So 529 education accounts can only be used for qualified education expenses to avoid taxes and penalties on the income and gain portion. There are some exceptions to the penalty, but not the income reporting if used for other than education expenses. So, for example, if your child has a scholarship of $5,000, you could take a distribution of $5,000 and avoid the penalty, but you would still have to pay the tax on the pro rata earnings on that distribution. So not necessarily the whole thing. So if you had put in $10,000 into a 529 and it grew to 20, then half of it is earnings, right? So if you took out $5,000 and you have an exception to the penalty because your child qualified for a scholarship of $5,000, you could take out the five. Only half would be subject to the income tax, but not the penalty because you have an exception. And there are other various exceptions, disability, death, scholarship, and I believe military. So you'd want to make sure that you understand what those exceptions are before you pull the money out. So again, you would not have to pay the penalties or income tax on the total distribution if part of it is earnings and part of it is an original contribution. There is no income threshold for contributions. So I had mentioned there's income thresholds for Roth contributions. There is no income threshold for contributions to 529 accounts. For those of us who are residents of Pennsylvania, we get a deduction on our Pennsylvania income tax return to the extent we make contributions to the 529s up to the annual gift amount, which is $15,000, or the amount of taxable income that we have. So if we only have, you know, $12,000 of taxable income and we made a contribution of $15,000 to our favorite child, we would get a deduction of $12,000. If we make $100,000 and we made a contribution of $15,000, then we could get the full $15,000. And that would apply if a spouse is also making a contribution. You both have to have income to get the deduction, obviously, on your share. There is a limit to how much you can put into a 529 in total, depending on what state you live in. And the limits are pretty high. And my person who asked the question is from California. So I assumed if they're a California resident, they can put up to $529,000 into the 529 account before they're, you know, prohibited from putting more into it. He had asked about what he called a 60-day return setup, like similar to the Roth. And I believe what he was referring to here is a 60-day rollover. So if someone, and I'll start with an IRA, if someone takes money out of an IRA, takes a distribution, they have 60 days to put that money back in, and it won't be treated as taxable. And you can only do that once a year. So if someone takes money out of a 529 and for some reason thinks they don't need it and wants to put it back, they have 60 days to do that, and it wouldn't be treated as a distribution. But you can only do that once per year per beneficiary. So the caution is if there are multiple 529s with multiple owners for the same beneficiary, you want to make sure that no one else has done a 60-day rollover. This could happen, for example, if parents have a 529 and grandparents have a 529, or an aunt and uncle has a 529. So it's kind of nice to let the folks know if you're setting up a 529 for your grandchild. It's kind of nice to let the parents know that you've set up one for your grandchild. Generally, you'd think you would know because, at least in Pennsylvania, you have to ask for the Social Security number of the beneficiary for the deduction on your tax return. So watch out for that. So the 60-day rollover means that you take it out of one plan and you put it back into another plan within 60 days, and you should let the new custodian know that that is what you did. The better thing to do if you wanted to change plans, maybe you like the Ohio plan and you had your money in the Nevada plan, in lieu of taking the money out and putting it into a new plan, you can do what's called a trustee-to-trustee transfer. And when the custodian does that, they mark the distribution document as such, indicating that it was a trustee-to-trustee transfer. So that is the better way to do it. And that is not called a rollover then, and you don't have to worry about those rollover rules. I thought I would throw this in as well. Distributions from grandparents, 529s, make an impact on an application for financial aid. You hear people talk about this all the time. If there's no expectation for financial aid, then it doesn't matter. So, you know, if the parents make tons of money and they're applying for financial aid and they're not going to get it, well, then it doesn't matter if the grandparents are taking money out of 529s to help their grandkids. But if you expect that there could be some eligibility for financial aid, then if grandma and grandpa or aunt or uncle or someone else has money in a 529, you want to caution them that you don't want to take money out of the 529 before, let's say, the junior or senior year, because the distributions from a 529 from someone other than the parent is counted as a resource for that child who is filing for financial aid. It's not income taxable to them, and a lot of people use these terms. I wish they would, you know, stop doing it. They call it income to the child, income to the child. Well, to me, income to a child is possibly taxable income. So I don't like using the word income. I like using the word resource. And if it's a resource to the child, that counts more towards what their contribution would be for their education cost, and therefore could impact the financial aid need. So watch out for that. Make sure you coordinate with the grandparents. So the parents could take it out for the freshman year, sophomore year, and then if the grandparents have money, let's have them do that a little later. But again, if there is no financial aid expectation, it's not going to matter. Someone also asked me today, coincidentally, and this worked out really well, I thought I'd piggyback this on to this question from Sam. Someone asked today, if they sell investments in their investment account, they sell some things, they take gains on it because they have to pay for the child's education cost. They wondered if they could exclude the gains from their tax return if they're using it for education, and or if they took that money and then put it in the 529 and then paid for the education cost of the 529. No, you can't. You know, some people get nervous about putting all their investments in the 529s for the kids, so they have like an account on the side, you know, joint or individual, where they've got investments. If you're pulling money out of a regular, you know, individual account, joint account, and you have gains on it, you're not going to be able to exclude the reporting of those gains just because you're using it for education expenses. That's the point of using the 529. And the reason the IRS has incentivized people to save for education and make that is giving the tax-free treatment, they actually want you to do it. You actually have to do it. Okay? So, no, you're not going to get any tax-free savings for education by taking those monies out and then putting them into the 529. So great question, Sam. Thank you so much for emailing that. Folks, if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live with me or give your question to Lori C. and she'll bring it in to me. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY offers many choices and real voices.
This is Karen Elchar. Join me and other hosts each weekday from 9 a.m. to noon for WDIY Classics, medieval to Baroque, romantic to modern, along with concert information and artist interviews.
WDIY is the Lehigh Valley's local source for NPR news, public affairs, and diverse music at 88.1 FM and streaming on WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY 88.1. Tonight's topic is more listeners' questions. If you have tax questions in particular, since it's tax season, I guess that's what I usually mean when I this time of year when I say more listeners' questions. Any kind of questions are great, though. The phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air or give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in to me, and I'll do my best to answer them. So we also had a question from Mary, and Mary had asked several questions, and so I'm going to tell you overall, it is about accessing IRA monies before age 59 and a half, had a little bit about lump sum, had a little bit about, pension options, things like that. So she said, and I broke it down and responded to her already, and I'm sorry she wanted me to answer in the first 15 minutes, but I did email her separately. She said, I know you cannot access IRA retirement funds before age 59 and a half without a penalty. I believe she probably learned that from WDIY, Your Financial Choices. I believe that I can access 401k retirement funds from the company that I retire from after 55 without a penalty. I am 56 and have not yet retired. Can you explain access to 401k before age 59 and a half? I think it is called rule of 55 or 72T. I'm just going to start by saying 72T is different. If you have terminated employment with that employer in or after the year you turn age 55, that is an exception to the 10% early withdrawal penalty if you take money out of the 401k. You would still owe income taxes. I always like to make sure people know when they're taking money out of their 401ks or their IRAs, there is income taxes, but you could avoid the 10% penalty. That is an exception if you have terminated from employment and you turn 55 by December 31st of that year, you could take money out of the 401k. That does not apply to IRAs. Big no, not out of IRAs. This is out of a 401k, exception to the 10% penalty. So sometimes people will early retire and, you know, go to their advisor and they'll say, let's get that 401k rolled over. Well, caution, flags, bells whistling. Be careful, because if you're not otherwise employed and you have no other access to money, you might need to take out of that 401k. So that might not be something you want to do, rolling it over to an IRA, because that 10% exception does not apply to IRAs. There is something called the 72T, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So you might want to keep it in the 401k at work until you get yourself, you know, figured out what you're doing with your cash flow. Some employers, though, require you to annuitize it. So, you know, I thought this was easy. You could just tell the employer, hey, send me $20,000. I'll pay income tax on it. No 10% penalty. But then I was told some employers say, no, we're not going to just send you money here and there. So you really want to make sure that you understand what your options are. So you want to talk to HR or to the plan administrator to talk about what the withdrawal options are once you're retired. I've had other people who do it, you know, hither, nither, or whatever they want. But I have been told that some employers don't do it randomly. So you want to make sure you understand it. I think I will throw in what the 72T is right now. So if someone has already rolled over their 401k and now they're in a pinch and they need money and they would be subject to the 10% penalty, you might want to measure or calculate whether it might make sense for you to do something called a 72T election. A 72T election is an IRS code section that says if you are under age 59 and a half, another exception to a 10% penalty is if you take out substantially equal periodic distributions from the IRA. And you have to take those out the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half. How do we know what substantially periodic equal distributions are? Well, there's calculations for it. There's like an annuitization method and another method. I haven't had to do it for a long time for people. There was a time, probably back in 2008, where more people needed that, but I haven't seen it in a long time. But there are formulas for it based on your life expectancy. And it does not have to be on the whole IRA. You could break up the IRAs and do it out of one account to get the right amount. But it's a tricky calculation because you have to know how much you need monthly. And that 72T calculation might not get you as much as you want. Or if you did it all on one account, it might be more than you want, which is why you might want to break up the account. And if you mess it up within that 5 years, the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, meaning you take out extra because, oh, it wasn't enough, you take out extra, you wipe out the whole election and you have to go back and pay the penalty on all of those distributions. So it's something you have to go into very, very carefully. All right. But it is an option for some people. The second question she said is, I have money in a 401k and in IRAs from previous positions. I believe these accounts are adequately funded and well-balanced for my age. My current employer has a pension program that will provide pension money. Pension money, you know, typically we think of a monthly pension, and they provide it as a lump sum or as an annuity. She's inclined to take the annuity as a way to diversify her income streams in retirement. Is this reasonable, or is it generally better to take the lump sum and invest it? Well, it all depends, Mary, and you have to be very careful about this decision making as well. So you'll want to explore your options. We're in a very low interest rate environment right now, so the lump sum amounts look very attractive. So when we're in low interest rate environments, lump sum options are bigger. So you would take the lump sum. If you were to elect the lump sum, you would roll it over to an IRA to delay the income taxes on it until withdrawn. So just because they tell you have this lump sum option doesn't mean you have to take the whole thing out and pay taxes on it in a lump sum. Generally, you roll the lump sum into an IRA. All right. And then once you have it into the IRA, you can take out, you know, distributions once you're age 59 and a half, or you wait until age 72. Okay, so deciding between a lump sum or a monthly pension amount has a lot of considerations, though. You have to think about, what are your cash flow needs? Who are your heirs? Do your heirs need some of this money? Will they need some of this money if something happens to you? What's your risk tolerance? Why do you care about your risk tolerance? Because if you're taking the lump sum and you invest it, how are you going to invest it? Are you going to put it in cash? Then maybe that's not such a good deal. Or are you going to invest it, you know, based on your risk tolerance and maybe get a little return on it? What's your longevity? Are you going to live a really long time, or do you have a shorter than normal life expectancy? You also want to look at your income tax situation. A pension, it's a monthly amount, it's income taxable. If you take a lump sum, put it into an IRA, you might be able to control the taxation of that a little bit better. Okay, now I have more to say on that, but if I try to get it in before our next break, you're not going to understand me because I'm going to have to talk so fast. So I'll continue the answer to this question when we get back from this next break. We're about halfway through, and I saw that John called, and I will also answer John's call when I come back from the break. The phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. And you can talk live on air with me, too. And if you're not comfortable doing that, give your question to Lori C., and she'll write it down and bring it in to me. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Good evening, Lehigh Valley. WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Coming up on 6:30, it's 50 degrees and overcast. Lehigh Valley weather tonight, chance of showers with a low of 32. Thursday, sunny with a high of 50, then mostly cloudy with a low of 32. And Friday, rain and snow likely with a high of 45, continuing into the evening with a low of 27. Now back to your financial choices with Lori Siebert.
Thank you, James. Welcome back, folks. Before I get back to the rest of Mary's question, John called from our Lehigh Valley, and he asked, explain the 709 form. The donor must report. Is it meant to offset future inheritance tax? So a 709 is a federal tax filing. It's a gift tax return. And so many people think if they gift more than what we call our annual exemption, you heard me earlier mentioning donating $15,000 to a 529. That's the annual exemption. That's why I use that number. That's what Pennsylvania allows per beneficiary. So the annual exemption, the federal government says that we can gift $15,000 to any one person and none of us have to report it. So I can give $15,000 to James, I can give $15,000 to Lori, and we don't have to report that anywhere. They don't have to report it, I don't have to report it. So that's a gift. It's an annual exemption. If I want to gift more than $15,000, the IRS tells us we have to report that. We file a federal gift tax return, Form 709, and we report the gift. So now let's pretend I give $115,000 to James. Well, if I would report on my 709, $115,000, the IRS gives me a $15,000 exemption, so I would report that I've made a gift above the exemption of $100,000. James just said, made famous in the movie Shawshank Redemption, this gifting. They did that. I saw that movie, but I don't remember that piece.
Yes, Andy Dufresne, the main character, was in, again, the prison, and the lead or head security guard had an issue where he was getting money from something, and he had approached him and mentioned this exact rule of the $15,000.
the annual exemption, very good. So they know about in prison. I was just reading an article. They also know about scamming people, and so be very, very careful. So the 709, the annual exemption is great, but there's still nothing wrong with gifting more than the annual exemption because the federal government gives us each a lifetime exemption right now of about $11.5 million. Well, I could give away a heck of a lot of money and never pay a gift tax as long as it's under $11.5 million. The IRS just wants to know how much of that lifetime exemption we're using. So if I give away $115,000 to one person, I get a $15,000 exemption. That wipes off that. I have to use $100,000 of my $11.5 million. I file a gift tax return to let the IRS know I used $100,000 of it. And that's because if later I hit the lottery and now I'm worth $20 million. My exemption was that $11.5 million. The IRS tells us we have to bring back those gifts we made. So I bring back the $100,000, I add it to my current estate, and then get that $11.5 million. Basically, what we're doing by gifting during our lifetime is removing future appreciation from our estate. Now, John, you asked whether it offsets a future inheritance tax. What happens if So the estate tax, we're removing it from our estate today. We're removing the future appreciation from our estate, but we are adding it back. If our estates aren't more than 11.5, and if we're married, it's, you know, 11.5 plus 11.5 is about $23 million. We don't have to worry about an estate tax. If we're residents of Pennsylvania, though, and we've transferred my $115,000, Pennsylvania looks back a year to see what we transferred, and they give us a $3,000 exemption per person. So of my $115,000, they're going to say $3,000 I don't have to, you know, pay tax on. So the $112,000 would be in my Pennsylvania inheritance tax if I didn't survive the year of my gift. If I survived the year, and now it's been 2 years, and I gave the $115,000 away 2 years ago, that does not come back into my estate for Pennsylvania inheritance tax purposes. Okay? So that does kind of help there. If you don't file the gift tax return, what happens? Penalties are assessed on the tax due. If you're under the exemption, there's no penalty because there's no tax, but it is important to, you know, file the federal estate gift tax return if you're making gifts of sizable amounts, and it kind of tracks it for you. Okay, so annual exemption $15,000, as the inmates knew on Shawshank Redemption. They know the annual exemption, and that can be from any one person to any one person. So I can have a $15,000 exemption to my daughter, to my other daughter, to my son. My husband can have a $15,000 exemption to my daughter, to my daughter, to my son. So right there, we can do 30, 60, 90,000. We can throw in the son-in-law and do another $30,000. I could gift $120,000 out of my estate today and not even have to file a gift tax return, as long as we're doing it right and both doing it. Okay? So, John, I hope that answered your question. You know, I always answer a little bit more than probably what you were asking for, but I hope it helps. If you guys have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk live on air with me or give your question to Lori C., and she can bring it in to me. I'm going to go back to Mary's question earlier, talking about the 401ks and IRAs and the option for her to take a lump sum versus an annuity. And in my answer, I said, you, in deciding between a lump sum and a monthly pension amount, you have to consider a lot of things: the cash flow needs, your heirs, your risk tolerance, your longevity, your income tax situation. If you were to take the lump sum, And in a low interest rate environment, that looks like a very attractive number usually, how would you invest it? And would it provide you an equivalent pension amount or more? So depending on how you invest, if you were to take the lump sum and you said, gosh, at 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, it could give me this, provide this month much of a monthly pension amount for how many years, it could be complicated, but if you like Excel, you could figure this out. You could figure out how much of a monthly pension amount you could give yourself, or if you just wanted to take the income off this lump sum, or if you want to use both the principal and income on that bucket that you're investing. This is what I like to point out to people. That pension is usually something that you've earned over the years of working. And they have calculated what I call a net present value to that pension. And that, in essence, is that lump sum amount. If you are single and you just take a single option and you die, you know, 2 days later, that money is gone. And you earned that, and that money is gone. That's why if you take a lump sum, you roll it over to an IRA, you can name a beneficiary, and that can go on, be preserved for some other loved one or for a charity if you're, you know, philanthropically minded. If you are married, you might choose a survivor option, 100% survivor, a 50% survivor, so that would impact as well, you know, what your total benefit would be over your lifetimes. And we can't always predict when we're going to die or how long we're going to live. So you have to make some best guesses and make a decision that's right for you. Typically, if you're someone who is just like spends it as soon as you get it, spend, well, a monthly pension is kind of better then because it might help you control yourself. But if you're someone who's disciplined and you don't overspend and you've got some risk tolerance, it might be worth checking out that lump sum amount. Okay, finally, she said, if an employer goes into bankruptcy after someone retires, would pension annuity income to retirees be protected and remain intact, or is there a risk that she should consider? And my answer is, if a company goes bankrupt and they don't have their pension properly funded, then they would fall back to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Sometimes you'll hear people say it very quickly, PBGC. It's the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Sometimes people don't receive their full benefit if it does default to the PBGC. But for most, they probably do. It depends on kind of the pension benefit that you had. There's certain thresholds that the PBGC, kind of sets. So if you're, a highly compensated person, you might not get your full pension, all right? But if you're kind of a regular earner, you might still get the full amount if they were to default. So that doesn't happen that often. We did see that here in the Valley with Bethlehem Steel. So people didn't completely lose their pensions. A lot of people were afraid of that, but it didn't necessarily happen. All right, so I hope that helped, Mary. Thank you for your question. Sharon from Allentown called in. She said 1099R, distribution code G, is that subject to Pennsylvania tax, and is code 7 subject to Pennsylvania tax? Sharon, great questions. 1099R, distribution code G, means it's a rollover. So you rolled it over from one plan to another plan. So that should not come in as taxable to Pennsylvania because you didn't take the money out. It was a rollover. You moved it from one plan to another. So not taxable. Code 7, if you're talking about a pension on a 1099-R, code 7, generally retirement benefits are not taxable to Pennsylvania. So we see code 7, that's for like a normal distribution. Code 7 we see on an IRA, 1099-R, but it would have a code 7 and a box checked for IRA. That's how we know it's an IRA. We might have just a code 7 when it's a pension, and the IRA box would not be checked. That tells me it's a pension, and that is not subject to Pennsylvania tax. If I saw a 1099-R and a code 1, that means early distribution, no exception applies. That could be taxable for Pennsylvania. If you have taken a distribution from a retirement account in excess of your basis in it, and good luck calculating your basis in a retirement account. It can be done, but then you might run awry of the Pennsylvania income tax. What Pennsylvania says is if you take out an early distribution, if your original contributions come out first, so if you took it out early and you know that you put in, $10,000 a year for 10 years into a 401k, that's $100,000, and you were like really in bad straits, you had to take $10,000 out of your 401k. Remember, we talked a little bit about this earlier. For federal purposes, it would be $10,000 income taxable for federal and a 10% penalty for early withdrawal. But for Pennsylvania, they say you take out your original contributions first. If I can prove I put $100,000 in, I took $10,000 out, it's not going to be taxable for Pennsylvania. But if my $100,000 grew to $150,000 and I was taking out $10,000 a year for 10 years, I've eaten away all my original contributions, and now I still have 50, and I'm still age 50. I'm still young. It's still an early distribution. I started doing this, 30 years ago. Then you would start eating into the income. Pennsylvania deems that to be compensation. It's crazy to me. And guess what then? The local also deems it to be compensation. For Sharon, your question, code G, don't worry about it. Code 7, I'm suspecting it's probably either IRA or pension and not subject to PA tax. one last check on the code 7 is if it's a code 7D. D indicates that it's an annuity, a non-qualified annuity. And if it's a non-qualified annuity and there's a taxable portion, that is income taxable for Pennsylvania, and it's deemed to be interest. It's deemed to be interest. So code 7D on a non-qualified annuity, the earnings typically come out first on an annuity. And if it's just a regular investment, not IRA, then that would be subject to Pennsylvania income tax. Great questions, Sharon and John. Thank you so much. Folks, if you have questions, there's still some time. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. And you can type live on air or just give your question to Lori and she'll bring it in. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY. Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11 offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. We're covering the topic, more listeners' tax questions this evening. I'll see what else I can cover here. Some things that, you know, basically even came up today, I thought I would share with you. For folks who have health savings accounts and you have, you're making those contributions through an employer, you're doing it through payroll deduction, perhaps your employer also contributes, you will have a code W on your W-2. That means the employer has already taken that money out of your taxable income. So the code W and the employer's portion, which isn't taxable at all, your employee contributions are part of that code W, and it's not subject to federal, state, local, or Medicare Social Security tax. It is really powerful if you can afford a high deductible health plan and you're eligible for a health savings account. That's how that gets reported, code W. What we often see is that code W is not always showing the maximum amount that you could put into a health savings account. So if you're over age 50 you have a family plan, you could put in $8,000 into a health savings account. If you're single, you can put in $4,500 if you're over 50. If you're over 50, you get an extra $1,000. So if you're not over 50, it's $7,000 for the family and $3,500 for single for 2019. The reason it's important to notice this is if you're preparing your tax return and you end up owing a little bit more money than you thought, it's like, geez, if you see that on that code W isn't maximized to the kind of plan you have until April 15th to contribute more money to your health savings account. And that could turn that tax due right around if you can get some extra deduction. So I have seen from time to time where someone comes in and they thought they'd put a little bit of money into their health savings account because they didn't really understand how these work. They thought they had to use it. You know, it's not a use it or lose it like the flexible savings account. And so they don't realize that you're saving that money pre-tax on all those levels. And then if you, if the money accumulates over time, you actually can invest that money. And when you invest that money and then use it for medical expenses, it's tax-free. It can grow income tax-free. So it's like a super win, the health savings account. Again, if you can afford a high deductible health plan. So let's pretend you look at that code W on your W-2 and you see that it was only $1,000 and you have a family plan and you're doing your tax return all by yourself using one of those great software products, if you only put in 1,000, you have a family plan, and you're under 50, you could put in 7,000. You could put in another 6,000. You put that on your return. What happens then? You get a deduction on your federal return. You get a deduction on your state return, and that's going to save you income tax. You don't get the full benefit like you do when you do it through payroll deduction, because you're kind of late to the party. So you're only getting the federal and state benefits. You're not getting the Medicare and Social Security benefit or the local benefit. So, but it still could be a really powerful tax saving for you up until April 15th. And then what I would suggest is you go back in and either at open enrollment or if your employer lets you adjust the health savings account, that piece I don't know. Can you change your health savings account contribution mid-year? I don't know. Check with your employer. But ordinarily, you make these selections at open enrollment time. And so at open enrollment, to the extent that you can afford the cash flow, do it through payroll deduction. And what you don't realize is if you're putting $1,000 into the health savings account through payroll deduction, but then you're writing checks for medical expenses out of your bank account for $5,000, you could do it through your payroll deduction, and it's not even going to cost you $5,000 because you're getting all the tax savings. So big, big alert on that. And I'm seeing more and more health savings accounts. That's the other piece. So once you start accumulating, if you're not using it for medical expenses and it's accumulating, you can transfer it usually to an investment account. You could use a target date fund. There's different kind of investment options that you could put it in, and you want to check and make a decision that's right for you. But don't miss out on that piece, because that's part of the power. You can let those grow income tax-free and use it for medical expenses in your future. It doesn't have to be next year. It could be when you retire. You could let that grow and grow and grow, get the tax benefits, and, you know, pay out of pocket for your medical expenses if you want. I was going to talk a little bit about completing the W-4. That's to adjust your federal tax withholdings, but I'm going to talk about that next week, so I'm going to skip that tonight because I'm going to go into more depth on that. I'm seeing more and more people talking about their withholdings, having more issues with their withholdings, so I'll talk about that a little bit more in depth next week. I want to mention something that came up when, you know, we obviously use software at our company for tax filings. And this wonderful software will tell us whether or not it will compare the tax consequences for a married filing joint couple versus what if they filed separately. And it will tell us, hey, you know, by the way, married filing separate will save this couple, you know, $600 or $2,000 or whatever it might be. And in the past, like, we rarely saw this, but I think with the tax changes, the tax code changes we saw a couple years ago, it almost practically equalized single versus married. And there's a lot of advantages to filing, you know, there could be advantages to filing separate now, because it's kind of like you're both filing single a little bit. So the caution is, watch out, because you might get some tax savings, but married filing separate could hurt you if you're over age 65 and on Medicare. So we had this come up. The couple would have had, I don't know, $600 of income tax savings for federal by filing separate. We separate the returns, and it hit me. Now we have two people filing separate, and I am a nut about the Medicare income-related monthly adjustment amount, the IRMA. If your income is over certain thresholds, they will increase your Medicare premiums. So they look back on the 2 year prior tax return, and they look at your income, and then they'll adjust your premiums. Well, the adjustment for married filing separate is huge. So for married filing joint couple, if your income, page one income plus tax-exempt interest or tax-exempt income is over $174,000. If it's under $174,000, your premiums are about $144 a month. If it goes over $174,000 but up to $218,000, then the premium adjusts about $58 a month. And if you're a couple, that's for both of you. Okay, so that's an extra $114 a month just to go to that next tier. And there's a bunch of tiers, and it can go all the way up to $492 a month per person from the $144, depending on your income. But guess what? Married filing separate, there's like no tier. You go over $87,000 married filing joint, $87,000 to $413,000, your monthly premium goes from $144 to $462 a month. Huge. And it times that times two, if you're both filing separate and you're both over 87,000, it could be really big. Sometimes when the married filing separate is better, it's because one spouse is earning like a very low income and the other one is high income. So sometimes it might be one might have the 462 a month, but the other might still have the 144 a month. You're still talking about some really big numbers. So be careful. Now, I mentioned that you could file separately to have some income tax savings. If you're under 65, it might certainly be something to consider. Pennsylvania, you could still file jointly or you could file separately. It doesn't matter. Pennsylvania really treats us like separate filers and just, you know, out of convenience, they let us file jointly. So watch out for that. Medicare income-related monthly adjustment amounts if you're married filing separate. Some people file married filing separate because they might not like what the other spouse is doing. Maybe one of the spouses is in business for themselves and maybe they're a little nervous about their business dealings. Then that could be a valid reason, but maybe it's not really a valid reason. Maybe you just don't understand the business and nothing wrong is going on, and, you know, get informed, because maybe that together you could save a lot of money by filing joint and avoiding some of these Medicare premiums. Another thing that's come up in the past, you know, year or so, as people were moving from equities, they might have done it, you know, part of 2019 when we saw some volatility. If you have treasury bills that you've invested in, when you redeem them, and sometimes people redeem them sooner than a year, treasury bill is less than a year. And if you redeem them, they might show up on your 1099B for brokerage, your 1099B from your financial advisor, financial institution, your custodian of your account, whatever it might be. If the treasury bill shows up as a sale, be careful, because if you read, it will say, this isn't really getting reported to the IRS, because it really is treasury interest. The gain is really treasury interest. So if you see treasury bill, you know, $5,000 cost and $5,600 selling price, $5,000 cost, $600 gain, you report it on Schedule D, it's going to show up as like a short-term gain. But it's not really a short-term gain. It's simply the proceeds, the difference is your interest that you've earned for that period on that treasury bill. You report it as U.S. Treasury interest. It is taxable for federal, but it's not taxable for state. And that's why it's very important that you report it properly, because U.S. Treasury interest is not reportable for any state, not just Pennsylvania, any state. All right, so watch out for that. So treasury bills are showing up on the broker's statements as a sale. With having said that, I'm not sure how software works these days. I used to use, you know, one myself, from a box, but now I just, you know, do it at the office. But there is, Pennsylvania changed a few years ago how they report the income on the Pennsylvania return. They match it. They start with the federal interest and dividends, and you have to make sure that you're reconciling it to the proper Pennsylvania numbers. So if on the federal return you have $2,000 of U.S. Treasury interest, some of the software is putting $2,000 on the Pennsylvania return if you haven't coded it as U.S. Treasury interest. And so you might have to make an adjustment. Or you might have $2,000 of dividends, of which some of it might be from U.S. Treasury, and it's excluded from Pennsylvania income. So you have to reconcile it. So just watch out to make sure that you're reporting that the interest and dividends aren't always the same from federal to state. So watch out for that. I hope that tonight people enjoyed listening to more listeners' tax questions. I love questions and I love tax questions, and I really appreciate the people who sent in the email questions through the website, yourfinancialchoices.com. That was really great. And I thank Sharon and John for calling in with their questions as well. We will be here next week. I'm going to talk about filing status, withholdings, estimates, and the W-4 form. If you think you need to change your withholdings, we're going to go through that. I want to thank James for being here tonight, Lori C. for taking the calls, and our listeners, of course. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive, and make the best of your financial choices. Have a great week.